This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about the nurse staffing shortage in Indiana and finding out what effect it's having on hospitals and patients and potential solutions to the issue. We're joined by Rachel Spalding, Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes, and Amy Pettit, Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schneck Medical Center in Seymour. Rachel, an Indiana House committee recently passed a bill that would do two things. The first is it would increase the number of people accepted into nursing schools in Indiana. How would that specific change help the nurse staffing shortage we're seeing now?
Well, it's been no secret that for years we've had literature and discussion around nursing shortage, and that we had an impending nursing shortage. And Amy will agree with me when we've heard for the last 10 years, you know, we'll be short a million nurses by 2010, we'll be short a million nurses by 2020. So, you know, it's been going on for a long time. And so, you know, for us, we have always been focused on increasing the pipeline, you know, into nursing schools. And we have, you know, various mechanisms such as the Title VIII reauthorization, the workforce reauthorization that was in place. And it did, you know, address some of these issues. And it was not reauthorized when we asked again in 2019, particularly for our congressmen. So we, you know, have had to look at various methods on how we're going to expand the pipeline, because honestly, you know, if we don't have, with the demand that we have today, if we don't have the supply of those that are interested or they feel their calling is nursing, enrolling into these programs, you know, we cannot turn out good qualified nurses to care for those of us in Indiana. And the reality is we have to increase the number of students going into programs while we can also maintain the quality at the same time. So that's the balance we're always trying to achieve. But at the end of the day, you know, we turn away in the state of Indiana hundreds of qualified nursing students because there aren't enough spots in these programs. And some universities have nursing shortages, you know, nursing faculty shortages, because, you know, there is a difference in pay as opposed to the practice side. There's a lot of reasons why, but we definitely have to increase the number of students in order to turn out more nurses to replace those that have retired. There's a myriad of reasons. And then, of course, with the pandemic, that's just accelerated all the reasons why we need to be graduating more qualified students.
The other change in this bill would be an increase in the number of part-time faculty in nursing schools. Would that have any effect?
Well, you know, the schools of nursing, you know, they have various reasons for how they determine the percentage of full-time faculty. And for some of their accrediting programs and some of the things that they're trying to maintain within their programs, they have a need for full-time faculty. However, we have so many qualified nurses that would love the opportunity to teach. And I'm going to let Amy talk a little bit about her role in that currently. But, you know, the thing is that we have so many master's prepared, doctorally prepared nurses that are totally interested in becoming part of clinical faculty and helping our local universities and schools of nursing be able to and be able to teach for them. So there's that opportunity to have more part-time faculty that could assist them with that. Now, I think they want to have the consistency in faculty so they can ensure quality. But at the end of the day, we have to have more nurses in the pipeline and to be able to take care of all those that need us.
Before I get to Amy real quick, I wanted to ask also if enrollment and part-time staff are the only things that House Bill 1003 is suggesting to change.
Well, and House Bill 1003, it addresses many things, but really that's what it is. You know, the author of that bill, Representative Manning, you know, had heard from many people before he put this legislation forth that, you know, hey, we have tons and tons of nurses that are currently in practice at the bedside and other, you know, doing education in hospitals. They're also working in our inpatient units. They're in our outpatient areas. They're everywhere that would love to teach, but they can't hire that percentage of part-time faculty. You know, so that has kind of held them back from having that opportunity in some cases.
Amy, as a hospital nurse and someone who teaches at IUPUC, are you in support of seeing these changes happen at Indiana nursing schools?
I am. And you're right. I do teach class. I'm an adjunct faculty at IUPUC. I've been an adjunct faculty for other nursing programs across the state. And the reason I teach is because I need nurses and they need faculty in order to be able to get me nurses. I mean, it is truly a relationship. And we work very closely with our partners in academia to make sure that we are providing very high quality faculty so that we can get these nurses. And I think Rachel alluded to earlier, I have several nurses who are master's prepared, some in a master's program. So they will be graduating within the next year. They are very capable of teaching. They have the clinical experience. In fact, they're doing the clinical job right now. And what a better way to really be able to teach that real life clinical experience is to get those people who are on the front lines currently.
Well, do you think hiring more part-time staff will make a difference at nursing schools?
So what I can tell you is that currently the areas of academia around us have decreased the number of students that they're admitting into the nursing program. This past year, we lost one full cohort because they did not have enough staff to teach. In addition to that, just to keep the other cohorts moving, they reached out to us and they basically said to the schools or to the hospitals around them, if you want us to keep this number of students enrolled, then we need your help getting faculty. And they pretty much said, if you don't provide this for us, we're going to have to cut more students. So yes, I absolutely 100% believe that allowing more part-time faculty would allow more admission into the School of Nursing.
And just so I know that I'm understanding this correctly, there's a limit on the number of students being able to get into nursing programs because there aren't enough faculty. Is that correct?
That's one reason, yes. And go ahead.
Oh, no. I just wanted to make sure I understood that, because then I'm thinking, well, how do you get the faculty to come and teach, and why is there an issue there?
Yeah. One of the things that I would say is not only when you talk about, and that's what I was getting ready to allude to, when you talk about, there's a shortage of faculty, but there's clinical placement. I think we also have to look at where's academia coming from. How many clinical spots do we have? How many students are we able to take on as organizations? And we have worked very closely, and I'm sure Rachel has as well. We have worked very closely with the schools around us to say, let's get creative about creating more spots for clinicals. Let's get creative about, can we do night shift clinical. We had a year ago, we had a weekend clinical for students who would come into our facility on the weekends, because there's only so many spots when you're a small rural community hospital. There's only so many spots for students, but allowing those students to come in at different times, that's another method. But we can open it up as much as we want. I mean, we're a 24/7 facility, right? And we can open it up as much as we want. But what we have to remember is you have to have faculty to be able to teach during those times. And when you are a full-time faculty in academia and you're teaching during the week, you may not be able, you're not going to be able to teach at night or on the weekends. So opening up those part-time positions also opens up the ability to allow for more clinical spots in healthcare organizations.
Rachel, with regards to House Bill 1003, some folks might be wondering, why does state government have any jurisdiction over the number of students a nursing school accepts and the number of part-time staff they have?
Yeah. And, I think what this whole pandemic has really done, the nursing shortage we've talked about for years has just accelerated. It's just accelerated and taken off to a point of where Amy and I, where we, have complete responsibility for nursing services and patient care. And, for us patients, that's the number one, we have to ensure that they're getting quality care. At the same time, we have to ensure that our, the well-being of our staff as well. And so the pandemic has just accelerated retirements. They've accelerated all these things, but because as a collective body, both practice and academia and nursing, hadn't had the opportunity or missed the opportunity to come together and address this issue before the pandemic, You know, we are now sitting in a position where it's now been dubbed a crisis by the American Nurses Association, and it's been dubbed a crisis. And some states have even declared a state of emergency because of their healthcare staffing and nursing staffing in particular. So, you know, all of us are highlighting that we need help with the staffing concerns. We need help, you know, in that area. And so, of course, if we haven't addressed it ourselves as a profession, if we have not taken the steps to mitigate the supply demand issue and solve the nursing shortage issue, then of course others see that it's really important and they're going to act on it. So I think that's where legislators stepped in and said, we see this as a severe crisis. We hear what hospitals are saying, what CNOs are saying, what CEOs are saying about their current situations, and they need help. So we're going to help. So we're going to create legislation. You know, and I think that with other partners that provided data to them, you know, they decided that they were going to author House Bill 1003. And, you know, it's something that we have to take responsibility for and say, we got to address it or somebody else will address it for us, because it does become a public health crisis at some point.
If I can jump in just real quick, I think Rachel makes a great point to speak to the fact that we've been talking about a nursing shortage for years. This is not new conversation, but what COVID has done is it has really heightened that awareness and increased the shortage. Things have changed. I have never seen the number of open positions in my organizations, even as a magnet designated organization where I can tout an excellent working environment. The number of open positions are something that really we've just never seen in healthcare before. And we had the opportunity to really work together. And I do believe that we have been working to try to fix this, but we needed to accelerate it. And again, just like Rachel said, when we have hospitals talking about the nursing shortage, when we have CNOs, when academia, they're absolutely understanding that there is a shortage and that we need to increase the number of students that we're putting out. When we're all talking about the same thing, but we're not moving on it, then someone else is going to come in, especially in a regulated field like this. Someone else is going to come in and said, let us help you to come up with a solution. And I think that's what you're seeing here today.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the nurse staffing shortage and the pandemic's impact on nurses right now. If you have any questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about the nurse staffing shortage in Indiana and potential solutions to the problem. We're joined by Rachel Spaulding, Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes, and Amy Pettit, Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schenck Medical Center in Seymour. Before the break, we were touching on House Bill 1003. Rachel, do you think most nursing programs in the state would be behind a bill like House Bill 1003?
Well, I definitely think that there are elements of this bill, because we have talked with academia extensively about this, as I serve on many boards across different organizations. And there are partners, just like Amy said, there are partners. We all have to go together in this. And we know that there are some, you know, we have experts for academia, we have experts for practice. And so we've got to align those to come together to come up with a way to ensure that we are increasing the pipeline. So with House Bill 1003, you know, there were a few things in there, such as the clinical simulation that they discussed, which really got a lot of discussion during testimony in the House. And, you know, it really, those were the types of things that, you know, I was happy to say I will defer to academia, because I feel like they're the experts and they understand what the outcomes can be, an increase of simulation over clinical hours. So, you know, with the patient face to face, you know, that would change the number of clinical hours they would have with direct patient contact. And so, you know, we did defer to our academic partners to say, you all need to look at the evidence, you all need to look at your curriculum, and you determine that, because for me on the practice side, that's not my area of expertise. And I respect that. And so there are some things like clinical simulation and the full-time faculty that really where are things that academia is going to have to work on and advise what's in their best interest of the students and ultimately for nursing as a whole. But there are other things in the bill that they were supportive of, you know, but it does come down to accreditation. So each of our schools of nursing have an accreditation, or they should be accredited. And there are several different accrediting bodies that have different standards that may speak to some of these different, you know, categories within this bill. And so they have to really ensure that they are going to be able to meet their accreditation standards as well. And so we have to definitely compromise and work together to come up with some answers to this bill and with a level of comfortability. And they are willing to step outside their comfort zone. And, you know, we're willing to support in any way that we can.
Is it too early to speculate the outcome of this bill? Are you hopeful it's going in the direction you'd like it to go?
You know, it went out of the House, I believe it was almost, 91-2. So it was pretty much unanimous out of the House. It will be heard in the Senate. I'm not sure exactly when that's on the schedule, but I do feel that there were some amendments made that I feel were in favor of really the compromise with academia. And I think academia still has some room for some other amendments, but they're willing to look at it and they're willing to say, hey, we want to be part of this, but we kind of feel like we got caught off guard and we want to be part of this answer and we want to provide our recommendations. So I think that's where we are. So I feel like it will go through. I think it's something that's needed, you know, for change to happen. And so I think that we'll get there. And I'm hoping that we can say that practice and academia move together and that we work together as one in that.
Amy, a lot of mention of the pandemic has affected so many different industries, and it's often brought as something that has highlighted what was already there. So, for example, you mentioned with the nursing shortage, it's been there, but COVID sort of exacerbated it and really highlighted it. Do you think if COVID rates decline, if we get a hold of this pandemic, it would offer more relief and this wouldn't be as much of an issue?
I think that, you know, this is, I hate to say it this way, but I think this is the new normal. COVID is not going to go away. You know, the rates may decline. We may get a bit of an ease in this variant, but COVID is still going to be here. And I think what we need to do as healthcare providers is that we need to say, okay, what have we learned that we can take out of this pandemic as it becomes part of everyday life? And what do we want to keep that we've learned? And then what do we want to change and do better? What can we do better the next time? What I believe is that after COVID, this variant declines, there could be another variant. I don't know about that. I anticipate that there will, because the virus itself is trying to mutate to stay alive. However, no matter what happens, we still don't have enough nurses to take care of our patients. Just the everyday patients that come in, not just COVID patients. My hospital is not full. Every single patient in the hospital is not COVID, right? We have a whole slew of different types of patients. Some of those patients are because they put off seeking care during the pandemic. They didn't want to come in. They didn't want to get their normal screenings. Those types of things. Some of these patients are very chronic patients that we've cared for years. Both of those exist. And then you have COVID patients. But nurses, I don't believe, are going to come back to the hospital setting just because this variant seems to ease up a bit. So that shortage is still going to be there.
I know there's also conversation about the shortage being due to seasoned nurses retiring. Do you think that if you increase the number of students being accepted into nursing school, there may be a gap before those nurses actually enter the workforce while the more seasoned nurses retire? And how worried are you about getting through that period of time?
Yeah, I think there is going to be a gap, because anyone who enrolls in nursing school today, you've got 2 to 3 to 4 years before they're going to complete that program. So there 100% is going to be a gap. And on the practice side, we've gotten creative about how we fill that gap. One of the ways that we're doing that is that we are using agency staff. We have a lot of support staff that we've hired, trying to increase our support staff to truly extend the nurse and what the nurse is able to do so that the nurse can delegate more to certified nursing assistants, to LPNs, to techs, to nursing students. We've hired a lot of nursing students to get them in the work setting. But I do anticipate a gap. And I think another, something else that I think Rachel would be fantastic to talk about is potentially even going outside of the U.S. and how, if can we hire outside of the U.S. in order to fill some of that gap? And she's had some success in doing that.
Yeah, you know, foreign educated nurses were also part of House Bill 1003 in regards to some required testing. But what I can tell you is that countries like the Philippines, they have an excess of about 250,000 nurses that do not have jobs. You know, nursing is a profession in which their culture really sees as a very honorable profession. Plus, it's part of their core values of how they care for others, and they're wonderful nurses and professional nurses as well. And they have the same level of education that's comparable to the BSN or Bachelor's of Science in Nursing in the United States. And, you know, we've used foreign educated nurses in the U.S. for years, and they really are a true answer to help us stabilize our workforce. So we work with many different agencies to get foreign educated nurses into the U.S. In January 2021, we worked with a company and started a process of obtaining these nurses, and we requested 25 nurses at that time. Well, here we are in January of 2022, and of the 25, I've only been able to get 5 of those nurses for a couple reasons, and it's mainly due to our government. So from the federal side, they changed the, in January, actually it was in April of 21, they changed the exit interview priority for healthcare workers. So healthcare workers were seen as the highest priority for exit interviews for their visas. And so they changed it to the lowest priority. And we really haven't got a great explanation on why they've done that, but we've talked to multiple legislators trying to get this change because the U.S. desperately needs these healthcare workers. They desperately need these nurses. And other hospitals have also made huge requests with not much return as well. And so part of the bill, House Bill 1003, was there's an exam called a CGFNS exam. And that exam basically just tells you, hey, you're going to pass the licensing exam, which is called the NCLEX, or maybe you're not going to do so well. But most of the time, these nurses have already passed the same licensure exam that our U.S. nurses do today. And so it's really unnecessary. And we're one of only 6 states that require this exclusively. And we're one of the, as well as it's only offered, I believe, once every quarter. That they offer the CGFNS exam. And there's 2 other pathways that you can also ensure that your foreign educated nurses are of the quality that we require. And so that bill, they wholeheartedly have supported opening up for more than just one pathway. So we'll definitely see some leverage there. But of course, if that bill gets passed in July of this year, it's going to be a year before that's truly put into action. So it's got some time, but foreign educated nurses are really a great answer. They come to your communities and they want to build a life. They want to become part of your community. And so far, the quality of care that I've experienced with our nurses, these foreign educated nurses have been fantastic. And they're part of our family and they're part of our community. And we're so glad they're with us.
That's interesting. I didn't even realize there was this aspect of the changes made to lowest priority for visas for folks in medical professions. Was there any explanation as to why that happened?
No, there really isn't. We've reached out to multiple legislators. We've reached out to the federal government, and we really didn't get an answer on exactly why they were deprioritized. You would think that during a global pandemic, that would definitely be changed and that would be a priority for those healthcare workers, but it hasn't, unfortunately. And the companies that work with these other countries to bring foreign educated nurses to the U.S., you know, I've supported them in providing letters and talking with legislators, various things to try to move things forward, but we just haven't seen any traction, nor really a good explanation.
Yeah, it sounds almost like there's more obstacles being thrown in the way. And as you mentioned, in the midst of a pandemic, you'd think mm-hmm. there would be looking at all angles of trying to cause some relief. I wonder, I'm just curious on my own end here. I wonder if part of it was maybe folks thought the pandemic was over in 21. We got the vaccines, it's going to end. And unfortunately, that was not the case.
You know, that could have been potentially part of that, thought process there. I think now that it has been brought to people's attention, I just don't think that it's gotten enough attention, honestly, especially after the ANA and others had called, this is a healthcare crisis. You would have thought that here we are almost a year later from when that change was made, that they would have tried to make a change. You know, they do have the ability and the power to do that. So you would have thought that maybe that would have been changed by now. But here we are, and we're still going to keep working to get that changed.
Amy, how do you explain to folks that we're in a state of an emergency with nursing? It's a crisis level.
It's extremely difficult when you're trying to get a bed at when you're a rural community hospital and you're trying to get a bed at a tertiary medical center and patients are waiting on beds. It's not that they don't have a bed, a physical bed or a physical room. Instead, it's that they don't have a staffed bed. And that is exactly what we are experiencing. The state has EM resources, which is available online, and you can go online and see how many hospitals across the state of Indiana are on diversion for ICU beds, for med-surg beds. And on any given day, of course, that varies because you have to change that hourly sometimes even. But it is difficult to see that we have so many hospitals that are saying we're on diversion. We cannot accept any patients. And when you're the hospital that is receiving a patient who needs a higher level of care and you cannot send them, you can't just send them because they don't have a place to put them. And you're having to say that to the patient or you're having to share that with a family member. It's extremely difficult. And what we're seeing is that we are having to board patients in our emergency departments. And research shows that that is not the best place to board patients who are critical, who have chronic illnesses for hours upon time. It's just not a good place to board them. Emergency departments were made for getting a patient in, stabilizing them, diagnosing them very quickly, and then sending them to that next level of care. And what we're seeing is that we're having to keep those patients in our emergency department hours, sometimes days. And what happens is when you do that, is that length of stay for other patients coming into the emergency department becomes extremely long. And patients don't understand that they have to wait hours to be seen for whatever they're presenting for. And so it becomes very challenging and difficult to explain to our patients and their families.
How do you handle that when you have to talk to families and explain that to them?
You have to be honest. As honest as possible. I think it's extremely important to continuously round on patients and update them. Here's where we are now. Here's what we've done. Here are all of the places that we called. We had a patient several weeks ago that we transferred. We're in rural southern Indiana, about an hour south of Indianapolis. And we had a patient that we had to transfer to the Cleveland Clinic because the patient was critical and we needed a staffed critical bed that was able to care for this patient, and we needed it sooner rather than later. And so the staff, my nursing supervisor, the hospitalist, the nurses, they called all around the state of Indiana and we could not get a hospital to take this patient. And so we ended up transferring this patient to Cleveland Clinic. Now that's quite a trek. When you can't fly by helicopter, we talked about chartering a plane. We talked about going by ground or flying halfway and then going by ground halfway. And you have to involve the patient and family members so that they know everything you're doing to care for their loved one. Because when they realize everything that you're going through and what you're trying to do for them, they understand. They understand to a point, but they still need care. And I think that's what we have to remember. And that's why it's so important, you know, when we're talking about a nursing shortage, that's why it's so important for healthcare organizations, for government, for academia to sit down at the table and work together to come up with a solution. It's not what's best for healthcare. It's not what's best for academia. It's what's best for the patient. And if we always are making decisions by putting the patient at the very beginning, or the right, and maybe always in the forefront of the decision that you're making, you're not going to make the wrong decision. Not ever, I don't believe.
Rachel, how about you? How are you handling this stuff?
What Amy described is exactly the same experience that we have 2.5 hours southwest of Indianapolis in a rural community. We serve 10 counties, about 275,000 in population, into Illinois as well. And, you know, Amy's exactly right. The delay of care that you're experiencing, especially when trying to transfer out patients to higher level of care. And then also, I mean, we get calls from all over. We get calls from the Chicago area begging us to take patients from some of their smaller hospitals or critical access hospitals around the Chicago area and further into Illinois. We've gotten calls from Louisville. I mean, we've gotten calls from, you know, very far distances to see if we're accepting patients, because this is a national issue as well as a local issue on just the availability of staffed beds. Just like Amy said, it comes down to the staffed bed. And, you know, you try to maintain patient throughput because that's what's best for patients.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the nurse staffing shortage and the pandemic's impact on nurses right now. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on the nursing staffing shortage and potential solutions to fix it in Indiana. We're joined by Rachel Spaulding, Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes, and Amy Pettit, Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schenect Medical Center in Seymour. Before we went to break, Rachel and Amy, we were discussing sort of what you've personally had to deal with, and also what this nursing shortage in general does for families and patients in finding staffed beds. I'm curious, Rachel, have you heard from patients or families that are now noticing this, that are like, we had no idea this was going on?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I talk to patients and families when I round in the hospital, as well as when I talk to the general public, they really didn't really understand how this has impacted people's ability to get care and the timeliness of care, and just that we've had to alter what we consider our standard of care. And, you know, it is just overwhelming to think about having to alter the standard of care because we don't have the necessary resources. And the general public and patients and families, they are surprised when you tell them, well, it's not necessarily that just because you're not a COVID patient doesn't mean that it doesn't impact everyone. This just isn't for COVID patients. This is for someone experiencing a stroke, an MI, you know, time-sensitive diagnoses that can change their outcomes, you know, depending on how quickly you can get to them. It impacts everyone that's coming to us for care, not just for those seeking care for COVID. But COVID, definitely, I can tell you right now, that would be approximately, you know, 30 to 40 less patients in my building without COVID. And I can tell you the majority of those are unvaccinated individuals. And if I didn't have them in the hospital, would it definitely help open up staffed beds? It would help open up some staffed beds to get people taken care of in a more timely manner when we talk about the availability of staff beds across the country and in our state. But it really does talk to, even if we do see these COVID numbers go down, just as Amy said, we're still going to have staffing issues. And it's going to take us not only 5, 10, it's going to take us several years to return to a baseline. And then will we ever be able to recover the number of healthcare workers that have left the bedside? But yes, families and patients are really surprised. And then when you explain, they're like, wow, thank you for explaining that to me. I really understand now what the healthcare landscape looks like.
I wonder if part of it is, you know, just always thinking that healthcare is there for us. Maybe having sort of this entitlement mentality where we're like, if we get sick, we're going to go to the hospital and we'll be taken care of, and not realizing there's a lot more to it than that.
Right. And I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, we are so fortunate in the U.S. that we have great healthcare and that we have just unbelievable technologies. But at the end of the day, if we don't have those qualified professionals to be able to provide the care and to use the technologies that we have today to ensure a healthy life, then we can't provide that care anymore. And we're so fortunate in our country. And this is the first time I think people have really seen what can happen when that infrastructure starts to decline or degrade because of just so much pressure that's been placed upon it. So it definitely is, I think, an eye opener.
Amy, does the CDC quarantine guidelines that came out that shortened the amount to 5 days, does that help at all with staffing?
It does help somewhat. However, for healthcare organizations, I think this entire time, the CDC has given some leniency in that they understand that when you're caring for COVID positive patients and you're COVID positive, that there can be some exceptions made for allowing staff members to come back early. However, I don't know about Rachel. I would say her organization is probably the same. But when my nurses get COVID, they don't feel well. And they're not able to come back and work. So there are times, I think, when you have, you know, just a few small symptoms and people feel like working. But for the majority, when you get sick and you have a fever, you're not going to feel like you can come back and work. And what I have experienced even in the past several weeks is that several of my team members, while the 5 days, decreasing to the 5 days is fantastic, the symptoms tend to linger a bit. So I have not been getting 100% of my nurses back at the 5 day mark because they just don't feel well. So then we are having to try to, you know, piece together for a longer extension on that 5 days while those individuals have been out. And while, you know, we think, oh, healthcare will always be there, I think you're somewhat right in that we've maybe been a little bit spoiled to think that. But the truth is that my nurses are out in the community and they're being exposed to COVID just like every other person. So when you look at the positivity rates, you have to include that that's a positivity rate for nurses as well, because they are part of the general population. And when you take an additional that number of nurses out of the mix, then you do have to change the way you think about how many patients you're going to be able to have on each unit and what do my staffed beds look like.
Rachel, how has that been for you?
Just like Amy said, you know, we're not necessarily seeing many nurses that are able to come back symptom-free, you know, in that five-day time frame. And those nurses work with very high risk patients at times. So we have to really ensure that we're being really careful. And so, you know, it's our job to keep those patients safe and really to ensure that our nurses are getting the full recovery they need. So we're using it on a case by case basis. It's not across the board. Oh yeah, I can bring a nurse back in 5 days because we really have to, you know, tune in to what's best for our patients and our staff. And, you know, that 5 day may not be it. And so we've taken a really more of a case by case basis on what we're seeing with that individual, because yes, we can't afford for them to be out sick, but at the same time, we have to also maintain the quality and safety in our building. And so it's really a fine line, and it's not really a solid answer to staffing issues. And you have to think too, with what Amy mentioned of not only not having enough nurses, but when you have a percentage of them out with COVID, it may not just be them. Their children are out. Now their daycares are closed. They don't have daycare. And so it's many things that impact our nursing staff that cause us to have these shortages. And so it really is compounded, you know, when we have high positivity rates that we're experiencing.
And I'll jump in real quick to talk just a little bit about the daycare. And I think a lot of places are getting very creative. When schools shut down in the areas, we had just last week, several schools in our area had to shut down because of the positivity rate, because of the number of faculty and students that were out of school. What we did is we opened Clubhouse Schneck, and we said, if your kids aren't in school and we need you to work, then bring your children in and we'll have a place where they can work on their homework. They can do their virtual school. We'll have someone there to be able to help with those types of things so that our nurses and other healthcare team members can work, can continue to work, but their children are taken care of. So I think what you if you ask across the state, people are getting very creative with what can we do to make sure that our team members are able to come to work. And that's just one thing that we're doing here at Schneck.
Rachel, some of the clinical training is simulation based. Do you think using simulation labs is enough to prepare new nurses for what they can expect at the hospital?
We've used clinical simulation in our programs in schools of nursing in their programs for quite some time. And clinical simulation is a great tool to bolster education. But what we have to be careful of, and what I've heard from academia and others and from the practice side, is that we have to be careful because it's not the same as having or giving direct patient care. And so there is a healthy balance there of being able to produce a nurse that is able to have comfortability with the patient and ensure that they got the quality of learning required. And so in the bill, it does talk about schools of nursing being able to increase the amount of clinical simulation. But like for an associate's degree program, that might be 500 hours. For a bachelor's, it may be 600 hours or more. And you have to think, if I could replace 50% of my clinical hours with clinical simulation, that means 250 hours in an ASM program, for example, doesn't necessarily have to be hands-on or have or require, you know, direct patient interaction. And it could be not necessarily in high fidelity simulation and like in simulation labs that are very high tech and very give great experiences. It could mean that they watch something virtual on a computer screen and make decisions based on the case scenario. So really, our academic partners in that bill, it doesn't really give a lot of definition to what clinical simulation means and what the definition of clinical simulation is. And so, you know, for us in practice, that's where we deferred. And we said, we support the bill, but we're going to defer to our academic partners for them to say what the appropriate amount of clinical simulation is to provide a well-rounded student that's going to be successful in their you know, practice setting or where they choose to practice. And, you know, for hospitals, we absolutely have to have high quality students, and we're willing to, you know, be able to be flexible, things like that, with the clinical simulation ourselves when it comes to teaching. But we really have to defer to our academic partners on what's the most appropriate balance of clinical simulation.
Amy, would you be concerned at all with 50% of a student's training happening in a simulation lab?
I'm going to echo Rachel's response. I think what we really need to think about is, number one, making sure that when nurses are trained, they get excellent quality education. Everyone learns differently. I might be able to sit in front of a laptop and do a artificial intelligence type of growing scenario and learn great, but someone else may not do well with that type of scenario. There's a lot of virtual simulation now. We have a simulation lab here at our hospital with mannequins, and they're very lifelike, but they definitely are not a live patient. So I think we have to understand what are the limitations around simulation. And when we say simulation, again, the bill doesn't define it really, but when we say simulation, what does it mean? What does it entail? What would be included in that? And I think those are all questions that we need to sit down with academia and say, how can we make this work? If this is what we need in order to get more nurses, then how can we make clinical simulation, how can we build it in so that we get great quality education to these nurses and we get great nurses in the end? And we do it in a method or a way that we fast track so that we can get nurses sooner rather than later. It's a difficult conversation to have sometimes, but I think back to the time during when COVID was rampant, you know, during that time, we pulled our nurses out of healthcare facilities because we didn't know what COVID was. We were in the middle of a pandemic trying to figure it all out early on. And we basically said, we're going to halt and we're going to stop and we're going to say, we can't have students in right now because we just don't know. We're just not sure what we're dealing with. And so a lot of those students were either delayed or they learned via simulation. And it may be such that if this bill were to go through, that we sit down and work with academia and we say, okay, if you're going to do this much simulation, then how can I, as the customer of the product that you're producing, a nurse, how can I help orient them differently? How can I change orientation to make sure that we get them that face-to-face or very hands-on work? Because we're still orienting these nurses when they come out, even though they've been through a program. It's not like we throw them to work and don't work with them and get them oriented. So what do I need to do differently? If we all sit down together, I think we can come up with this sweet spot where this much simulation is very appropriate and it meets the needs to grow nurses quicker and to grow more nurses so that we can get them in the workforce quicker.
If students were able to do simulation labs, would it help with the staff shortage of teachers?
I think that probably not, in that the only way it would help would be if you were looking at your off prime time education opportunity. So your night shift or your weekend, something like that. But having a teacher in a simulation lab with a certain number of students is still going to be the same number of students, because you still have to have a teacher there instructing, making sure they're doing it right. So I don't think that would make a difference. I think where the difference it comes is that they don't have to be in the hospital setting as much time. Again, when you're a small rural community hospital and you only have so many patients, then you can only take so many students at the same time. So simulation would replace having to have students. It would double the number of students. It would replace them having to be in the hospital. You could have part of them in the simulation lab. You could have part of them in the hospital setting. Again, another solution that I've talked about is you could have part of them on day shift and part of them on night shift. But then you have to have, again, that double the number of faculty, which goes back to the conversation about part-time faculty.
Before we wrap up, I do want to ask, what have you seen, or have you seen any changes since we last spoke in September, Rachel?
Well, I think that what we have learned so far is that this is going to be a time where we've had to really sit back, and Amy mentioned this in the beginning, and say, what have we learned this far? What have we learned? What have we done that's worked? What have we done that's not worked? So it's really been an intense time of just really evaluation of where we've been, where we're going. How do we prepare for the future? How do we make better decisions in our emergency preparedness, et cetera? But it's really not that it's changed a lot. We've had times of highs and lows in between variants where, you know, things seem to, for a little bit, you kind of catch your breath, but it goes right back into another variant. And it's been really difficult. What I do know is I still need more people to get vaccinated. I do know that. And I, you know, really talk to people about, you know, determining what their risk is and what's best for them in this scenario. But, you know, our nurses desperately don't want to see more people with severe illness. And, you know, it is very difficult on them when we have large number of deaths in 1 week that just are not what you would normally experience. So we're still experiencing situations that just are almost humanly unfathomable at times. And so I would just say, you know, if you know a healthcare worker, tell them thank you, cook them a meal, you know, just let them know how much they mean to you and mean to your community. Let them know they're not alone and that you see them and you know they are going through a difficult time. I think that speaks more volume. It speaks, you know, louder volumes than anything else you could do right now for healthcare workers in general. But we've not seen a ton of changes, but what we are doing is we're learning and we're adapting and we're continuing to change and become more and more flexible and figuring out how to define what our next steps are. So it's, how do we put out this fire today? What are the decisions being made? Okay, let's go to the next step and taking it one step at a time. And this is definitely a marathon and hasn't been a sprint.
Rachel Spaulding is the Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes, and Amy Pettit is the Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schneck Medical Center in Seymour. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.